Downloads of this show are available on Podomatic.com and the Podomatic mobile app.
I am Velocity Child, and every Friday at the stroke of midnight, ride the broomstick with fallen woman, stirring up the cauldron at Radio Free Brooklyn.
Backed up creativity is when you will not allow yourself to create. In other words, it isn't because someone stole your creativity, it isn't because you killed it off, it's because of an act of the will or even an act of cynicism. You decide that you're just simply not going to create. You'll fix them, whoever them is. Except, and I have to tell you something that is very important, and that is that when people do not create, they become ill. And I don't mean necessarily sick in body, but most certainly sick in spirit. Creativity. Understand this in the context that I mean it. Creativity is a lot like excrement. It truly is. It is something that needs to be excreted from your psyche on a regular basis. Otherwise, it turns into a toxin and it poisons you. And that's the absolute truth. So it really doesn't matter if shoveling the snow is a creative act for you, or watering the plants, or taking a walk, talking to strangers, raising a child, whatever it might be, you must do it. And you must do it in your way and on a continuing basis. It doesn't mean that you have to complete a heroic sculpture every week, or that you have to write a novel within a month, or anything like that. It just means that you must be using your life in the way that you know best, from the center, every single day. If it backs up, it hurts and pollutes you. It causes you to become rigid. It makes you tired. It makes you look lifeless. It deletes your passion. It makes you brown around the edges. I love that story about one of the Impressionist painters who is sitting in his yard, surrounded by his flower gardens. He's sitting under a shade tree in a wooden chair. He has his straw hat on. He has his hands leaning on his cane. He's just sitting there. And a neighbor comes by and leans over the fence and says, "Monsieur, you're resting, eh?" And the great painter says, "No, I'm not resting, I'm working." And a few days later, the painter is out in his garden, busily painting on his easel. And the same neighbor comes by and leans over the fence and says, "Oh, monsieur, you are working." And the painter looked at him and said, "No, now I am resting." There is a rhythm to the way that we work, and the staring that we do off into space usually means, A, that we are no longer attached completely to our bodies, that we have traveled into the outer or inner space, as you will, of the mind and the imagination, and that there we are constructing images and having feelings and sensations about those images, that we are constructing words and sounds, and that we are having feelings and sensations about those words and sounds, and that we are in the act of creation right in that moment, and that when we are actually with the fountain pen or with the typewriter or with the brushes or with the notebook or the scoring sheets or whatever it is we create in, that it is not in that moment so much that we are creating as when we were in the quiet time, or in the solitude, or in the space of aloneness. You know, there's a saying about writers in particular, but I think it's as true of other artists as well, that it's a very lonely life. But most artists sort of smirk when they hear that, because they're not lonely at all. They have all the things and people inside their heads to keep them company. People, ideas, and images that are endlessly fascinating. So rather than saying writing is the lonely art, or people who are artists live a lonely life, it'd probably be more properly said that artists might be socially retarded because sometimes they don't have the social interaction with other people that might be useful and beneficial for them, because the people, the figures, the entities, you might say, that live inside their imagination are all they really need in order to feel fully alive in the internal life. So all these are matters of artistic hygiene, you might say. Ironically, creativity also works on the same principle as sex. You know, you can have sex in order to make a child, but you can also have sex to show an expression of yourself, or to show your creative self, or to share yourself, or to give pleasure to another person. And that's true about creativity, too. It's not necessarily to make a product, although that's very nice and good, but it's not necessarily even an expression of self. Sometimes it's simply a giving of pleasure to yourself or others. The pleasure to self often is something that we call numinosity. It means a feeling state that unequivocally reminds the artist that all things live in relation to one another. And that recognition or realization by the artist is accompanied usually by a feeling of ecstasy or bliss. So one might say that the reason many artists are driven to their work once they finally understand how to connect to it on a day-to-day basis is that they're actually driven by ecstasy. They're driven by the repetition over and over again of entering over that threshold into the unconscious, where the spirit gives profound pleasure through the feeling of oneness with the creative self. But there's also a dark side, and that's what we call in depth psychology overvaluation or possession. And what that means is that there's an archetype, a spirit, if you will, that's different than the human spirit. A muse would be another name for it. And that this muse is attracted to people who create. And some people describe it as a sensation or a feeling that's sort of otherworldly. And some people describe it as a sudden energy or a grace that fills them during a time when they're being creative and that has, as we were saying earlier, that numinous effect upon them. Other people describe it more parapsychologically, that there is something that inspires, that fills us, that is a mystery. Now, people who feel a deep calling or mission in life spend most of their time in a love affair with the muse. Without the muse, they would be like an empty paper bag lying on its side in the wind. For them, to be filled with the muse is a way of life. But for others, and sometimes I think it happens mostly to people who are new and innocent and not entirely seasoned or experienced with a creative drive, the muse grabs hold of them. Suddenly, they forget to eat or sleep. They're so enthralled with what's going on. They have such an idea. They have such a concept. They have such a goal, a product in mind. And they are working at it and working at it and working at it. And it's going wonderfully. And they cannot believe it. And they are in an ecstasy. And they are in a bliss. And by God, their health breaks down. They foreclose on their mortgage. Their children are angry with them. Their spouse won't speak to them anymore. They wake up one morning and everyone's packed and gone. And all of a sudden, the artist is back to earth again. Oh my God, what happened? And they say, I don't know. I have no idea. Something just took me. And there are old stories, for instance, in Greek mythology about how sailors who are passing through the place of the crashing rocks would tie themselves to the mast of the ship because the sirens were there. And the sirens were like mermaids, beguiling women who sang so beautifully, and they lived under the sea. And they were so compelling that for some reason, just in those moments of going through that particular strait, the sailors would suddenly believe that they could live underwater too, that they could go down and join the sirens, and that they would not drown, that they could breathe underwater, that they could live there for the rest of their lives with these lovely, lovely women. And so given that this madness would come upon them if they didn't tie themselves to the mast, they would jump overboard and happily, but nevertheless certainly, drown. So you see, this phenomena of the otherworldly muse or the inspiratrice or the person who comes from a plane that is not quite human and lures the human being into some kind of destruction is an ancient story. That's why in olden times, many of the art forms were taught by master-apprentice relationship, because the master, as you know in the story of the Sorcerer's Apprentice, the master had control of all the forces that come together in creative life, and the apprentice would learn them gradually and over a period of time. In Curanderismo, there's a saying that these archetypal sorts of angels hover around creative people, that they are wonderful and that they are fantastic, but that they don't understand human life because they're not human. So they do not know. It's not as though they're malicious, but they do not know that humans need to eat and sleep and love, and that humans need to take their medicines and pay their bills and do this, that, and the other thing. So there's supposed to be a separation, a recognition, in other words, of an archetypal presence that comes over you in your creative life so that you do not give your life over to it. It becomes a part of your life, but it does not take you away from life. Again, the measurement is, does it make your life bigger, richer, deeper, or does it take life away from you? There's another aspect to creativity that has to do with excesses. You're probably well aware that many artists, for instance, particularly those written about who lived in the early part of this century and the last, were known to live lives of debauchery and excesses of all sorts, sexual, financial, drink, drugs. And you may wonder, well, if I'm going to accept that I am an artist and going to be involved in all of this mystical, wonderful prima materia, does that mean I also have to be crazy? Well, of course the answer is no. Of course. Of course you don't have to be crazy. And no, it doesn't help to create, to be crazy. But the problem of excesses is very important and very real. It often occurs in a person who has had creative life withheld from them for years. In other words, if they are a painter, they never had paints or paper. Or perhaps they had people surrounding them who would not support their art by buying them the materials. If they were a writer, perhaps they were harassed every time they sat down to write. So when a person such as this is growing up, many times they jump into excesses as a way of making up for the starvation in their creative life that they experienced as children. Whereas they had no spiritual food before, now they are going to have so much, they're going to make themselves sick over it. And so maybe you have a person who is an artist, for instance, who buys 10 of everything just in case. They have 10 palettes, 10 French easels, 10 sets of pastels, 10 brushes of each number size, and so on and so forth, because they are fearful of running out or of having something happen and not having their tools. That is an anxious neurosis. I don't know that this is the worst thing that could happen to you in the world, but hoarding and caching things can be a sign of a far earlier starvation. And you can look into correcting that sort of thing by assuring yourself that there is enough for you, that nothing is leaving this planet, and that you're not going to abandon yourself, and that you're not going to allow yourself to be put in a position where anyone can abandon you or force you from your creative life or keep you away from your artistic or soulful instruments. The idea of excesses sometimes shows up in the drive toward drugs and alcohol, and sometimes people become worried that they'll lose touch with the creative nature, that when they call upon their creative nature, it will not be there for them. Now think, for instance, of a person who has a gift for, say, the guitar, and say as a child they were hindered from doing that they were not allowed, that they were made fun of for trying to be a musician, and they certainly were not given lessons or giving encouragement or support. And as adults, they decided that they were going to be a musician anyway, and by God, they have a real gift for it. And they pick it up very quickly, and they're very talented, and yet they fear that they may lose touch, that they may not be able to touch that center anytime they wish to. And so they may turn to alcohol as a means to perk up their imaginal life, as a means to reassure them that all will be all right. So the excesses often start out as remedies or palliatives for anxiety and nervousness, and they're meant to help, but in fact wind up enslaving the person instead. And so they are drinking or drugging or sexing themselves silly, and the creative life is no longer, and the physical health suffers. And every now and then, they will stand off the booze just long enough to write one brilliant poem or one brilliant story or one brilliant song, and then go right back to the substance again. They meant to fulfill their creative life. They, in fact, wound up being addicted to the very things that were supposed to help that actually don't help at all. So all of these discussions lead us to a very critical point, at least in terms of archetypal psychology, and that is, how do we contact all of these aspects of inner life within ourselves? We have negative complexes, and we have aspects of ourselves that we might call Persephone or Demeter or Baobo or Hecate or Hades. And we have shadow material being anything that perhaps you once knew but you no longer know anymore, or something that perhaps you forgot, or something that was repressed by the ego into the unconscious because the ego, for whatever reason, couldn't tolerate the content of that material. So we might say many aspects, many personages run loose in the shadow of each person's psyche. And what we wish to do in order to hold our creativity close to ourselves and to keep it in as good shape as we possibly can is that we want to be able to speak to these discrete parts of ourselves that are often just outside our mundane consciousness. In other words, we want to be able to call down to them and bring them up and dialogue with them, find out what they want, what they're like, who they are, how long they've lived there, what they're composed of, what their intention is, how they would like to participate in our life, how we can make them cease doing things that are disruptive and instead do things that are conducive to our creative life. There are many ways of calling the aspects of psyche. One is through a process that Carl Gustav Jung called active imagination. And active imagination is not booga booga, and it's not hypnosis, and it's not woo-woo, and it's not anything peculiar. Well, maybe just one woo, but a very pragmatic woo at that. Active imagination is the essence of creativity because it's based on the ability to imagine images, words, sensations, to register them and to find meaning in them. Jung wrote an essay called The Transcendent Function, which you can find in his collected works, which goes into great detail from his empirical point of view about how the whole mechanism works. In a simplified form, this is how active imagination works. Don't try too hard at it. It's very, very easy. Preferably sitting up, sitting on your bed, sitting in a chair, sitting on the floor, relaxed. You know, not necessarily a Buddhic posture, but with your spine straight and whichever way your body feels best. And most people bend their spines a little bit and sort of relax into themselves, but do whatever feels good to you. And so next, you choose a character out of your dream life or out of your daydreams or imaginations, perhaps even a character that comes to you as you are writing a story or painting a picture. In this case, perhaps imagine that we want to talk to the critic. So as we're sitting there, we imagine what this critic might look like, and we allow pictures to come into our mind to show us the aspects of this entity or this aspect of psyche that we call the critic. So, in one of my own active imaginations, during a time I was struggling with a poem, here's how the images and dialogue went. In my mind's eye, I saw an odd person who looked like what I would call a bookie. You know, a person who places bets and takes bets for other people. He has a homemade haircut, and he's smoking a cigar, and he's a real tough-talking guy. And I say, "Are you the critic?" And he says, "Yes, I am." And so now we are in the act of imagination proper. And I asked him for information. I'd like to know why he seems to have this kind of stature. I mean, maybe he could wear the morning suit and a cane and he would look more elegant. No, this fellow looks pretty seedy. And so I asked the question, "Why do you come to me dressed this way and acting this way?" And the first thing that comes to my mind is the response. The first thing that comes to my mind, even though your ego might try to negate it, don't let it do that. First thing that comes to mind is the response. And in my mind, the first response I heard with my inner hearing from him was, "You need to be more earthy. That's why I'm here." So I said to him in return, "Well, why do I need to be more earthy? I'm already a muy mucho earthy person. Why do I need to do that right now?" And he responds, and I can hear him with my inner hearing as he explains that I've been following a train of thought in the writing of this piece that is a distraction rather than right on the head. And he's concerned about wasting precious time. So I listen to him and I realize this is a pretty good observation. And so, in reality, consensual reality, I stop the direction I was moving in with the poem, and I go back to the center of myself again, the earthy, rich center, and I begin again. So in active imagination, you start out with an idea or a question or an issue, and you ask one of the inner characters that lives inside of you to come to you and help you, talk to you, give you thoughts, or speak to you so that you can hear their voice or do actions, that you can watch or do things that make your body have sensations that mean to you yes or no, or pleasant or unpleasant, or go this way or that way, so that you can have an interaction with whomever it is. And you can ask questions like, "Who are you? What is your name?" That's a good place to start. You can ask, "What have you come here to tell me?" If there's an adversarial relationship, you can say, "Why are we enemies? Why are we not cooperating? Is there some history here I don't know about?" And then the first thing that comes to your mind is the response. It is a true conversation, a true back and forth between you and other aspects of yourself that are not clearly conscious to you. Even though these hidden aspects of your nature may have value systems that are different than yours, and their way of speaking may be different than yours, the point is that they're very rich in information. And this is how we make a transformation and an amalgamation of ourselves and our inner complexes. We do that by having a conversation. Jung said that active imagination was even a more profound way of knowing the unconscious psyche than dreams. And even among the old healing people, for instance in the Curanderisma tradition or among the Sonoy, this ability to speak to inner figures is considered the best way to gain up-to-date information on what goes on in the farther reaches of the psyche. Because we are awake when we seek the information, because we are conscious, we can remember better. In dreams, of course, at night, we are asleep, and memory is less certain. Even though at night there is the dream ego, that's the part of you that's active in the dream itself, and the part that helps you to remember when you awaken. Even so, it's iffy at best. One of the beauties of active imagination is that you can do it for as long or as little as you like. You can do it anywhere, day or night, any place, any time. You can do it in your car. You can do it standing up. You can do it sitting down. You can do it at the office. We really don't recommend that people lay down to do active imagination because sometimes they become so relaxed they go to sleep. And that's all right if you're tired, if you need the rest. But it's better that people be upright so they don't fall asleep. The only problem that people talk about having with active imagination is that sometimes they don't believe what they are seeing or thinking or sensing. They say, oh, I think I'm making it up. I think I'm making the answers up. I'm making the responses up. But probably they are not. The rule of thumb that I use with that is that if the responses make sense to you and are enriching for you, then let them stand. Regardless of where they might be coming from, just let them be. The ego does try to interfere sometimes and direct conversations, but that's all right. Whatever comes to your mind, whatever comes to your mind, whatever comes over and over, whatever comes to your mind, let that be your answer. And then ask the next question. Sometimes in active imagination, more than just a dialogue occurs. There was one time when I did an act of imagination, one of the many that I've done in my life. And this one was at least 20 years ago. I was walking in the park with a gentleman, and it was the 18th century, and I had the most wonderful walk and the most wonderful conversation. Less of a spoken aloud conversation, more like an understanding between two people, things passing back and forth without words. And the person taught me all about the plants and the lakes and the flowers in this particular park. And when I was done, I realized that the information, though important, was not as profound as having the attention of this particular person, and that I felt something I did not feel before the act of imagination, and that was that I felt rested, and then I felt complete. I felt as if I had actually walked through a very beautiful and very lush park, and that I had somehow in my body had that experience. In my physical self, I felt like I had awakened from a very restful nap and went on for the rest of my day with high energy. So, active imagination can leave you with a sensation that is very, very good and very productive for you. It's not only information, in other words, can be a sensation of the whole body, of rest and of peace and of goodwill. So, in conclusion, probably the most important thing you can do for your creative life, for this spiritual practice that is your creative life, is to remember that you have to reach into the dark places to find it and to nourish it, and that the dark is not a horrible place, but a place of gifts. And that, though there's a natural inclination of the ego not to go into the dark because it says, no, no, danger is terrible. God only knows what's in there. You know, and I know, that your only hope is to go in after what the treasure is there or what you have lost. In other words, going into the underworld. Here's a very short poem by Opal Whiteley, who was 4 years old when she wrote this poem. She was living in a lumber camp up in the Northwest, and she had only one friend who was a little girl who was blind. Today, near eventide, I did lead the girl who has no seeing a little way into the forest, where it was darkness and shadows were. I led her toward a shadow that was coming our way. It did touch her cheek with its velvety fingers. And now she too does have likings for shadows, and her fear that was is gone. and so may it be for you.
Close your eyes and begin to breathe slowly and deeply. Take care that your spine is straight. This allows your natural channels of energy to open up and flow freely. Turning your attention inward and leaving the cares of the world behind, you are devoting this time to align your entire being with the divine source of the universe, the infinite, all-knowing, all-loving power that is within you and around you always. Depths of your heart, sincerely offer your problems, worries, and concerns to the divine source. Surrender all your fears, needs, and desires. Surrender it all to Shakti. Rest in the feeling that you don't need to do it all. That there is an infinite power that you can count on to guide you and fulfill your deepest needs. Begin breathing the ocean breath. Allow the constant activity of your mind to grow calm, quiet, peaceful. Let the sound of your breath carry you deeper into yourself. 3 long, deep breaths. On the third inhalation, hold your breath in and begin breath of fire. Pump the breath out using your abdomen as the bellows. Bring your awareness to the bundle of nerves behind your eyes that reach deep into the center of your brain. Allow those nerves to soften and relax. Your jaw grows heavy. Muscles of your cheeks soften and let go. softening all the muscles inside your throat. Send the energy down into your diaphragm and abdomen. Soothing whirlpools of energy spiral through your solar plexus, illuminating and expanding the core of yourself. delicious waves of energy flow down into your root chakra, gently opening and awakening the Kundalini. Feel your connection to the earth deepening. And infinite flow of life-giving energy cascades through you, igniting your life force, clearing away inner and outer obstacles, awakening more joy, more love, and more abundance in your life. As we prepare to complete this meditation, look once again at the magic you have begun to explore.
Cauldron at Radio Free Brooklyn.